Good morning. Today is March the 22nd of the year 2023. There remains 284 days in this year. So boy, there's plenty of time to do planning, getting your summer vacations in order, and just whatever you want to do. You have plenty of time to take care of that. Welcome to A Voice of a People live here on WGA's Talk. My name is Linda Sims. We also stream live on the web, www.wwgh1071.com. Now that is on your internet, okay? Also on that web, you can also scroll down to what particular show you would like to listen to, and you can pull up past archives of different shows that we have, okay? Now, you can download a free app on any electronic device called TuneIn, T-U-N-E-I-N. Once you download it, in the space where it says search, type in WWGH. Or if you just want to call in just to hear your voice or to ask questions of my guest or myself, please call 740-383-9944. I'd like to share with you those who faithfully support A Voice of a People, and that starts with Logos Christian Ministries, Pastor Jackie Peterson of 582 Lee Street, Marion, Ohio. Phone there is 740-223-1515 or www.logoschristianministries.com. Ongoing announcement, free produce will take place April the 15th of 2023. This starts at 12 noon until 2 p.m. We also have Cheryl Lee. She is the coordinator for Child Evangelism Fellowship, known as the Good News Club's faith-based after-school program, which are located in all of Marion City Elementary Schools, Marion County Schools, and all of North Union County Schools. If you would like to ask questions about that program, you can go to your school's office where your children attend and pick up a application. They must have parents' approval or a signature on the form. Or if you would like to make any donations, please direct them to Cheryl Lee. And her phone number is 740-262-0939. Last but not least, Chappie's Hydraulic Hose Specialist LLC of 1325 North Main Street in Marion, Ohio. Phone there is 740-382-8552. And when I say last but not least, I just want to say thank you for those of you who faithfully support A Voice of a People. Thank you so much for your support. And if it's your first time, I pray it will not be your last time. I'd like to start my show off with a thought for today. And it's titled, Sow a Thought. Sow a thought and reap a deed. Sow a deed and reap a habit. Sow a habit and reap a character. Sow a character and reap a destiny. Hopefully that will help you throughout your day. And if so, please share that with someone else. And maybe, you know, it would help them. Okay. Now let me turn my attention to my guest today, Fred Malone. How are you, Fred?
I'm good. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming. He is here from the Marion Historical Society.
Mm-hmm. Marion County Historical Society,
Marion,
yep,
County.
Correct.
And how's things going?
Very well, actually. We are in the process of finishing up the exhibit that we will be featuring this year. Every year, I think I've mentioned this before on your show and previous shows, that every year we completely change out the exhibit in our main atrium, which is the primary area on the first floor of the museum, where the post office employees used to sort the mail,
right.
Which the public didn't see, but that's what happened there. But we change that exhibit out every year so that we always have something fresh and new for people to look at. So when I ask people, have you been to the museum And they say, yes, I was there 3 or 4 years ago. My response is, but have you been there lately? Because
right.
things change. So we're getting real close to having that ready for the public to see. Our first event this year is actually coming up this Saturday. So you can get kind of a sneak peek at what the exhibit looks like if you come down on Saturday night. It's called A Night at Heritage Hall. And this is the 17th year that we've done this event. I talked about it at our last, when we were together last. Mm-hmm. And I want to mention it now, of course, because it's here in just a few days. So on Saturday from 6 to 10, you will be able to attend Night at Heritage Hall. And if you ever saw the movie Night at the Museum where the characters come alive,
yes.
this is basically what this is. We darken the museum. When you come in, we give you a flashlight and turn you loose in the museum. And of course, we have two floors, our main floor and the basement floor. And you'll have an opportunity to walk around in the dimly lit museum. There will be some lights in there, so you won't fall. But it'll be dimly lit. And you'll be able to meet historic personalities and discover many new things about our past as you travel through the exhibits that will actually be springing to life in the museum, which is a 1910 Federal Post Office. The building was built in 1910. We acquired the building in 1989, and it's been the home of the Marion County Historical Society ever since.
Wow.
So, again, this is this Saturday night, the 25th. From 6 to 9, and you don't have to spend the entire 3 hours there. You can come at 6 and wander around for an hour or whatever you want, or you can come at 8 and wander around for an hour. Our characters will be there for 3 hours.
Okay.
Normally, it takes most people between an hour and an hour and a half to get through the museum if they are engaged with the people that are portraying historical
right.
figures. And that's what we tell our reenactors. You know, you don't have to give an entire history of yourself that you're portraying, but at least go up and talk to the guests and tell them who you are and what you're main purpose in life was.
Right. Yeah.
And you may find people from Ohio's history, you may find people from Marion's history, or even U.S. history. This year, some of the people that you will encounter if you come, and this isn't a list of all, but some, Colonel Jared Mansfield, who was a surveyor general appointed by Thomas Jefferson in 1803.
Okay.
He will be there. He was surveying all of the Northwest Territory, which at that time was actually the eastern side of the state of Ohio before it became a state. In our newly formed telephone museum, which just opened last year, we'll have two switchboard operators that you can talk to, one from the early days of telephones in the early 1900s, and then one more in the 1950s to 1960s era, so you can talk to those people. We do have a World War I soldier that will be with us this year. He will be stationed actually outside the telephone museum with our newly acquired doughboy.
Oh.
Now, this is one of the doughboys that actually stood in the Memorial Park, the Veterans Memorial Park, just down the street, actually. And when this was, when these doughboys were put in, there were five of them made. And they knew at the time that they were going to deteriorate over a period of time.
Right, right.
So as the current doughboy that we have aged, he was brought to the museum and then replaced with another one in the park. So that's kind of cool to see.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people never make it out to the park to see that doughboy, and now they can see the doughboy, and there'll be a reenactor there as a World War I soldier.
So what's a doughboy? Help me.
That's what they called the World War I soldiers that were sent over
okay.
to Europe to help fight the war against Germany at the time.
Okay.
And then in our upstairs, what used to be our parlor has now been fashioned this year for the exhibit as a turn-of-the-century kitchen. And so we will have a farm lady there with two of her children, and she'll be talking about how tough things were during the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression that occurred in the late 20s and the 1930s.
Right.
President Harding will be there Saturday night. He'll be there in the Harding Rooms
okay.
to greet you and talk to you. Mary Ellen Withrow, who will be portraying herself, obviously,
right, right.
will be in the Mary Ellen Withrow Room, which houses her museum that used to be at Primrose. We have a gentleman that will be portraying a store clerk in the Racket store downstairs near the industrial room. And most people in Marion, if you grew up in Marion, remember the Racket Store. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Kreeder, whose husband was president and founder of the Kreeder Popcorn Company,
right,
will be there in the Popcorn Museum. The first African-American barber will be there with some of his family, and he'll be in the shop if you want to get a clip.
Okay.
We have a lady and her husband that will be down in the auditorium or someplace in the museum. She plays the harpsichord, and her husband will be talking about vintage toys that children may have played with back in the 1800s and the early 1900s. I have a gentleman that will be portraying Lorenzo Dow. Lorenzo Dow was the first evangelist in the Marion area, and this would have been in the 1840s that he was here traveling around spreading the gospel. I have a young lady who's portraying a Red Cross nurse volunteer that will be in the medical exhibit, that which features a lot of things from the Sawyer Sanatorium and some of the local physicians and dentists that were in Marion back at the turn of the century. President and Mrs. Dolly Madison will be in the museum. I have Dick Cooper, that's his actual name, who will be showing children furs. Fur trapping was very popular and a very lucrative business in the early days of Marion when it was still a wilderness. So Dick will be there showing different furs of different animals that would have been trapped or caught here in the Marion area. I have a Native American gal that will be talking about what life was like if you were a Native American. Of course, we had Native Americans in Ohio,
right,
up until the time of the Greenville Peace Accord. And then I have a gentleman that's going to be portraying Jacob Hauser. Jacob Hauser, the Hauser family, was a very prominent family in Marion. They actually are the folks that owned Prince Imperial, who was a Percheron horse. They purchased the horse from Louis Napoleon of France in the 1860s, had it shipped to the United States, and had it on their farm, which was right across the road from the River Valley High School. The big brick house that sits back a long lane there on, what is that, State Route 95?
95.
That goes down through there. That was the Hauser property. And we actually have that horse at the museum.
Do
when
you?
The horse passed away, the Hauser family couldn't bear to bury the horse, so they contacted the circus up in New York and found out where they had had the great elephant Jumbo taxidermied and sent the horse up to be taxidermied. So now we have that horse. For years it sat in the entryway of the home there on Route 95 in the Hauser home. And when the last Hauser died and moved off the property, it was given to the Historical Society for permanent display. So you'll be able to see that and talk to Jacob Hauser, who actually bought the horse, and get his opinion of why he bought the horse and what they did with it over the years. So that's just a few of the people that you will see if you come to a night at Heritage Hall. Again, it's Saturday, March the 25th from 6 to 9. If you are a member of the Historical Society, it's only $5. If you are a non-member, it's $8, and it's well worth coming to see, and it's children-friendly. We encourage you to bring your kids along because they will thoroughly enjoy talking to the people from their history and maybe learn a few things about Marion and some of the history
of our
country.
I'm sure there's so much to learn.
And I'm going to leave this with you. If you get a chance in the next couple of days to mention it before Saturday, I'd appreciate it.
I will.
I've talked about a lot of things about the Marion County Historical Society, and it dawned on me that in all the years that I was with Glenn and Charlie, I never ever gave a history of the Historical Society. So I've got just one page of notes here. I want to talk about how the Historical Society got started and what our mission is. So,
go ahead.
The Marion County Historical Society was formed as a result of a series of adult education classes that were taught by Marion Judge Charlton Myers. Now, if you've been around Marion for any length of time, you've heard of Charlton Myers. He was a common pleas court judge in Marion for years and years, and was a historian and very interested in the history of Marion County. An organizational meeting was held in February of 1969 with 75 individuals joining that evening and an eventual total of 248 individuals joining as charter members. And a number of the charter members are still around. For several years, the society had no official home. Meetings were held in different locations, and donated items were stored in members' homes and other buildings. In fact, Charlton Myers had a big barn on his property out in the county, which housed a lot of the things that we now have housed in the archives at the museum. Temporary headquarters were eventually secured above Lipley's printing shop. Everybody knows where that is. In 1981, our first property was acquired with the donation of a small cottage at 255 South Main Street. Very small. Renovations were completed and our collections were moved to their new home. Now, in 1988, the Marion Post Office building at 169 East Church Street became available for purchase. That's when they built the new post office out on Barks Road.
Right.
After more than a year of discussions and negotiations, the membership took a huge financial risk and purchased the building for $78,000. Now, that was a lot of money in 1989. The society named their new home Heritage Hall. A major contributor in terms of both financial support and leadership was George K. Brown of the Wyandotte Popcorn Company. And, of course, as a result of that, well, I'll go on. His offer to provide a monthly payment for the use of dedicated space to house his collection of popcorn and peanut machines made the project financially feasible. Today, more than 45 fully restored popcorn machines and peanut roasters are housed under a huge circus tent in the Wyandotte Popcorn Museum, which is in the rear of the Heritage Hall in the addition that was put on in the 60s. Extensive renovations and improvements have been made to the building, which opened in 1910 with additions in 1924 and 1936. Reconfiguring spaces for exhibits and storage, updating of building systems, and the installation of an elevator are just a few of the numerous changes. In 1990, Heritage Hall was added to the National Register of Historic Places. The Marion County Historical Society is proud of our organization and our home as we continue with our mission to collect, preserve, and share the history of Marion County. And it's important that we always remember it's Marion County, not just Marion. A lot of people get confused because it's in the city that it is a city museum. It is not. It is a museum of the whole county. So 15 townships and all the small villages and burgs that have either come and gone or still exist in Marion County are all part of the archives. We have over 34,000 items in the archives today. That's quite a collection.
Yes, it is.
It really is. And that has actually been a problem for us because we are running out of space to house those archives. We are currently in the midst of a capital campaign. We're in our 15th month of the capital campaign. And this is a campaign to raise nearly $1 million. Our roof needs repaired. The building itself needs a lot of exterior and interior improvements. And the HVAC, or the heating and cooling system in the building, is very aged. So that's what the $1 million will be spent for. To date, we are about 64% to our goal, so we're still about $300,000 short of where we need to be. So the capital campaign is ongoing. We are meeting and have met with all of the 15 townships in the county asking for their financial support. We've got support from the state of Ohio through their capital budget for 2023. They awarded us a $200,000 donation. The county commissioners have given us $235,000 towards our capital campaign, and the corporations and individuals have raised the rest to put us up to that 64% goal, or 64% of where part of our goal. So it's extremely important that people continue to think about the Marion County Historical Society, either in donations currently, or think about us if you're doing estate planning. Over the years, we have acquired some funds from bequests, from wills, from people that had been either members or interested in the Marion County Historical Society. So that's always a possibility as well. So just wanted to mention that. As far as collecting, preserving, and sharing through the generosity of our members and the Marion community, as I said, more than 34,000 items have been donated. These items are accessioned into a searchable database, and then archive for use in research and also for display in our rotating exhibits. We have a program called Museum Pass Perfect, which is used by museums all over the world, and that's the way we catalog our items. They're photographed. When something comes in, it's photographed. A description of the item is given. It's assigned a number and a session number and a location in the archives, and then filed and put away. That way, whenever we start to do an exhibit, we can pull up that particular category and find whatever's available for that category. For instance, part of our exhibit, the upcoming exhibit, will be some of the fraternal organizations that existed in Marion. The Knights of Pythias, the Masonic Lodge, the Eagles, the Elks, places like that. We can pull that up as fraternal organizations or organizations, and then Museum Pass Perfect will tell us what we have in our collection that we can use to put on display for people to see. We do a lot of educational programming for both schools and the general public. Among those are tours and programs at Lynn School, which is our 1897 one-room schoolhouse located out on Old 423, or Route 4, I'm sorry. The Cider Log House, which is located at the county fairgrounds, built in 1851 and relocated to the Marion County Fairgrounds. And hundreds of students that tour Heritage Hall and Lynn School every year in the spring will be due 4th and 5th grades kids that come through. And that's been going on for quite some time. So it's a fun program. I like to do the one-room schoolmaster out at Lynn School when the kids come because that school, of course, has no electricity, never did have, has no running water. We had to acquire water from across the street from the family that lived there. And so it's interesting to the kids to know that there's no Wi-Fi available.
Right.
There's no electricity in the school. There's very little heat in the school because it was heated with potbelly stove.
Right,
so
right.
It's
so
quite an experience for kids.
They didn't have the well, like the old well pumps?
No, actually there was never a well drilled on that property. Mm-hmm. So they went across the road to the family that owned the house over there, the farm family, by the name of Lynn. That's mm-hmm. where they got the Lynn School from.
Okay.
And the teacher would rent a room at the Lynn's farmhouse, and that was where she lived when school was in progress. And then in the morning, she would draw water from the Lynn's well, carried across the street to the school in a bucket, and that was the water for the kids for the day.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. We do a lot of public programming. Programs are presented throughout the year with a variety of topics. We do dinners, of course, featuring presidential reenactors and first ladies who share insights on their lives and while they were either in the White House or afterwards. And the foods that we give during that presidential dinner are actually taken from the original White House recipes. So you get a chance to eat the same type of food, for instance, that George Washington would have eaten, or Andy Jackson would have eaten, or Harry Truman would have eaten. So, and that's pretty interesting for folks.
It is very interesting.
We have a wide variety of publications that relating to Marion County's history, in general as some specific topics. Those are available in our gift shop at Heritage Hall. And I might say there are a lot of local authors that have written books about Marion County on various different subjects that we have available. And that's probably the primary source of our gift shop anymore, are publications and books that local authors have written. And there were about a dozen of them that have written books here in the area. So we're pretty fortunate for that as well. And then assistance with research on topics related to Marion County is available on a limited basis, of course, depending on our availability of staff in the museum. But also the Marion Area Genealogical Society, which is housed in Heritage Hall, provides research assistance as well. And they usually have someone staffing the research center on Saturdays. Excuse me.
Now, is that the official day of opening up the Heritage Hall Saturday, March the 25th?
No, that is just a pre-opening. We won't actually open the museum until May 1st.
May 1st.
And that'll start on weekends, and then when June comes, we'll be open from Wednesday through Sunday, five days a week. Yeah. And when I come back in April, I'll talk about that opening again some more.
Okay.
So we'll have some more information. More information on that. Couple things I wanted to mention before we move on to our main topic today.
Okay.
On April the 15th, up at the Mohawk Historical Museum in Sycamore, which is up in Wyandotte County, we're going to be having Mary Ellen Withrow Day.
Okay.
Mary Ellen will be at the museum between the hours of 11 and 2. She'll be there to talk to people, take pictures, sign autographs, whatever the case might be. It is our grand opening, or our open house. The museum had been closed down much of the last couple of years because of COVID, obviously. So we decided to have this kind of an open house to try to get people in and also give the people of Wyandotte, Crawford, Seneca County an opportunity to meet Mary Ellen and have a chance to talk with her. You know, here in Marion, we have an opportunity quite a bit because she does a lot of things in Marion.
Yes.
But as far as the counties to the north, not so much. Yeah, so.
I so admire her. I tell you. 91?
Excuse me. Yeah, she's going to be 92 this year.
Oh,
yeah.
My. And it's still amazing. Getting around, yeah. Still driving, making appearances.
Actually, I said that wrong. She's going to be 93 this year.
93?
Yeah, 93. Oh, she was born October the 2nd of 1930.
Oh, my.
So this is 2023, so she'll be 93
this
year.
You have to admire her,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, man, really. That's amazing. So we encourage people to come up that day. Our museum in Sycamore is right on the corner of 231 and 103. Both of those, they intersect right downtown Sycamore, and you can't miss a museum. There's three buildings. We built a new building over the last couple of years to add to our two original buildings, so we now have three buildings which house our collection there. And it got its name as Mohawk Historical Society because of the Mohawk School District, and the Mohawk School District actually takes in parts of three counties, Wyandotte, Seneca, and Crawford County. So it's a pretty good size area that we cover. We also own the Opera House in Melmore, which was built originally as an opera house. And over the years, it became the Township Trustees Hall. We bought that several years ago, and it's now turned back into an opera house where we do a lot of programming.
Right.
And again, everything that we do at Mohawk is totally free. There's no admission charge for the museum, and when we have events at the town hall or the opera house in Melmore, those are all free events too. And we've had the new Christy Minstrels have been there before and perform. And you know, if you were around in the 50s and 60s, when folk music was popular, the new Christy Minstrels were very popular on the scene. So we've had them there, as well as gospel groups. We've had barbershop quartets. We've had individual musicians there. So we try to do about a half a dozen events throughout the summer. And again, those are all free.
Right.
But again, this event is April the 15th, which is a Saturday. From 11 to 2, we'll be featuring Mary Ellen Withrow that day, and you'll get a chance to meet her, talk to her, and also see the Mohawk Historical Society's museum, which is small compared to Heritage Hall,
okay.
But for a community of less than 1,000 people, it's pretty nice.
Okay.
Yeah, so
sounds like it.
Wanted to talk a little bit about that as well. We are always talking about U.S. presidents. And today I thought we would kind of change things up a little, at least for the majority of our program today. I want to talk about first ladies. You know, first ladies especially the more modern day first ladies, provide a service to our country that is really, you can't pay for it.
Right.
For what they do. And I will point out that first ladies, unlike the president and the vice president, they don't get paid. They're there with their husbands. So everything that they do, they're doing out of the goodness of their heart.
Right.
Because they are representing the United States as the first lady of the land. So I think it's really important that we remember those first ladies.
And you're right, they do not get paid.
They do not get paid, no. And you think about what they do. Depending on what first lady you're talking about, generally when they come into office with their husband, they'll pick a particular thing to work on during their administration. And I always think about with Nancy Reagan and her fight against drugs, and Hillary Clinton with education. You know, And this is kind of like their pet project. And they spend a lot of time and effort. They have a staff.
Right.
They have an office. They have a real presence, not only in the White House, but in the world.
Yes, they
and
do.
And probably the most, when you think of first ladies, at least in my mind, I always think of Eleanor Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
And what an impact she had on this country, because her husband was confined to a wheelchair and could not get out. And she traveled the country, even going in coal mines and places like that, to find out what the people needed, what they wanted, what they were talking about, what they were thinking, how their lives were, and that type of thing. And then, of course, when you think about Michelle Obama.
Right.
And what an impact that she had on young black women.
Yes.
And young kids. So first ladies are oftentimes overlooked.
Yes, they are.
So today I want to talk about first ladies.
Okay.
And again, I can't remember all these things, folks. So these information that I'm providing comes from a book which is called Which President Killed a Man? And I think we talked about that
did.
I was here last month, about which president killed a man. But today we're going to concentrate on first ladies. So we're going to start out with, which first lady was a British subject and the daughter of a British army officer? A lot of these are little-known facts. Elizabeth Courtright Munro was the daughter of Captain Lawrence Courtright of the Royal British Army. Now, he was a wealthy Tory merchant in New York City, and Tory was a political party.
Okay.
Who saw most of his fortune confiscated during the Revolution. Munro, President Munro, who was 10 years older, married the elegant Elizabeth in 1786. Munro was then a member of the Continental Congress from Virginia. So that's where she came from. Which First Lady, and this is very important, which First Lady rescued the Gilbert Stuart portrait of George Washington from a fire in the White House? Now, the fire in the White House occurred during the War of 1812. When the British stormed Washington, they burned every building in Washington with the exception of the post office building.
Right.
And, of course, they burned the White House. Dolly Madison, in the War of 1812, the Royal Marines landed in Washington and burned the White House. Now, it didn't burn it to the ground, but it completely destroyed the interior of it.
Right.
Before they did so, on that August day, Dolly Madison arranged the safe transport by carriage of certain treasures, including the Washington portrait. She wrote her sister, quote, I am still here within sound of the cannons. Mr. Madison comes not. May God protect him. A wagon has been procured. I insist on working until the large portrait of George Washington is secured. It requires to be unscrewed from the wall. Now, interestingly enough, Dolly didn't climb up on the ladder to take the portrait down, which sometimes I think is a misnomer. But what she did was, she got the gardener at the White House to bring an axe, a hatchet, and she got her husband's manservant, who had actually grown up with President Madison. He was a young black
man.
Okay. And he grew up, he was born at the same time Madison was, and they grew up as children together and became close personal
friends.
Okay. So she got him to climb up on the ladder and cut the portrait out with this
axe. Hmm.
So Dolly Madison and a young black man saved the portrait
of President Washington.
President Washington, yes, that was done by Gilbert Stuart, right?
Wow, that's
so fascinating. And I read a book about the gentleman, and I can't remember his name now, but Madison made sure that he was educated.
Mm-hmm.
So he was an educated black man, which was really highly unusual in the 1812,
yes.
You know, 1814 era. And he went on to, he kept a diary, and he went on to write a book about his life, and it was a big seller. It was widely publicized in the day. So I always like to point that out, that he was actually the one that cut the portrait out of the frame. They weren't able to take the frame down because it was secured to the wall.
Right.
But he took an axe and cut the tapestry out, and it was saved. Who served the longest in the role of hostess or first lady at the White House? Now, some presidents either didn't use their wife as a first lady or in James Buchanan's case, didn't have a wife because he never married, but they might have used a niece or a friend or a sister, whatever the case might be. So we've had first ladies that weren't always married to the president, but they served in the first lady capacity and were still called first ladies or hostess. In this case, Dolly Madison. She first took over the arrangements for the widower, Thomas Jefferson, because when Thomas Jefferson was president, his wife had died. Jefferson, though he came from a background that had built up the new Democrat-Republican Party, he was always stressing that everything should be equal. Even though we had a two-party system, parties didn't mean anything to him.
Right.
At the newly built president's house, by the way, he was the first one to live in the house after it had been completed. John Adams and his wife were the first two that occupied the executive mansion, but it wasn't done on the inside.
After it was redone, right, because of the fire.
Well, this is actually before the fire.
Before the fire?
Yeah, this is before the fire. The fire was in 1812, and we're in 1803 right now. So he had no first lady. It was a catch-as-catch-can in seating. The Secretary of State, James Madison's wife, soon set him straight. That protocol was necessary to preserve a sense of order and dignity. When Madison followed Jefferson's two terms with 8 years of his own, she served as first lady in her own right. So she served first lady for Jefferson and then another 8 years for Madison. So there are 16 years there. But her leading hostess roles were not over. When her husband died, she took her niece Elizabeth to meet crowned heads of Europe and then maneuvered Elizabeth into marrying the widower, Martin Van Buren, his son, John. Elizabeth took over the first lady's duties in the Van Buren White House, but Dolly always had the final say on the invitations for state dinners and what went on. So she actually spent about 20 years as being a quote-unquote, either first lady or hostess at the White House.
Okay.
She was a very interesting woman, very instrumental in what went on in the country in the early days. Which first lady was the president, first president of the National Society of the Daughters of the American Revolution? This one I found very interesting. And as a little tidbit, the secretary for the National Society of the Daughters of the American Revolution lives in Marion.
Oh.
And that's Jan Augenstein. She's been the secretary for that organization for a number of years. In fact, she will be going to Washington sometime here in the next couple of weeks for the meeting of the National DAR.
Okay.
Carolyn Scott Harrison, the wife of Benjamin Harrison, was the first lady when the DAR was established in 1890. The society's members are composed of those who can prove that they have an ancestor who had military service in the War of Independence. It was incorporated a year later, and the First Lady was elected to be the first President General. Her husband was the grandson of President William Henry Harrison. Mrs. Harrison was also the person that erected the first Christmas tree at the White House, which I thought was kind of interesting. Yeah,
that is interesting.
Yeah. And
how many years had the White House existed before the first Christmas tree?
Well, the Harrisons came in the 1880s, so roughly 75, 80 years, something like that.
That's
before
a long
they had
time.
Yes, because the White House was actually built and completed. We started building in 1801. The Adams moved in, and they were there 1801, 1802, and then Jefferson came in 1803, and that was actually when it was all done. And I think the Harrison's first term was, well, he only served one term. I think he was 1878 to 1882, something like that. So roughly 75 years before it actually had an official Christmas tree.
So now it's a big event.
Now it's a very big event,
for the first lady to decorate the White House for Christmas.
Yeah, and not just one room, which would have been all they did then.
Right.
You know, this would have been a complete
overhaul.
Yeah, I mean, I think practically every room in the White House is get some sort of decoration.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and it is a very big deal. Interestingly enough, William McKinley's grandfather is my great 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 great-grandfather. So I can actually belong to the, and I've never done this, I can belong to the Sons of the American Revolution, which is the SAR.
That's neat.
But I've never done it. I should go back and do that sometime.
Yeah, you should.
Before I pass away. Which First Lady was aunt of her husband's second wife? Which First Lady was the aunt of her husband's second wife? This is very interesting. Same lady that we just talked about. Carolyn Scott Harrison came down with tuberculosis in 1892. Her niece, Mary Scott Dimmock, a widow, filled in as First Lady. After Benjamin Harrison left the White House, he married Mary Scott Dimmock, the niece.
Okay.
In 1896. Harrison's grown children resentful at the ex-president's marriage to someone 25 years younger than him did not attend the wedding.
Oh,
okay. I guess they were rather upset that dad married a younger woman after their mother died.
Also, it had nothing to do with the fact that she was part family of his former
wife. No, it was a fact of it was her age. Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, because there was actually no blood relation there.
Okay.
Yeah, no blood relation, just by marriage.
Okay.
I don't know how many people actually know this, but Mary Todd Lincoln had a lot of problems. She was a spendaholic, which most people don't realize. She bought dresses like most people would buy food.
Mm-hmm.
And her husband was constantly worrying about expenses because in those days, the president was responsible for what was spent, and it came out of his salary.
Right.
So she had a lot of ongoing issues. I mention that because we're talking about her now. Who was the only First Lady committed to a mental institution?
Oh.
Mary Todd Lincoln.
Okay.
She was committed to an asylum by her only surviving son, Robert. You know, they had three sons. Two of them died as children, and then Robert lived to go on and have quite a career of his own in 1875.
Okay.
The death of her son Willie was the first breaking point. The assassination, of course, of her husband unhinged her even further, and then when her son Tad died in 1871, she began hallucinating about seeing him. She was then put into an institution in Batavia, Illinois, and was released a few months later. So she did spend about 5 months in an institution, and it was her son that put her in.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say this, when she came out, she was a much better person than she was before she went in.
Oh, that's good.
So apparently it did do some good. But she did have a lot of issues in her life, and especially as First Lady. I'm trying to think of some of the other things. She had a personal seamstress that lived in the White House with her, who was a black woman, that did all of her dresses and all that type of thing. And actually, they became very close friends,
mm-hmm.
and I can't remember her name either. I used to know all these names, now I can't think of them. But she actually wrote a book as well about her life in the White House, which I thought was very interesting. And I have read that book, and it's very interesting. Her name will come to me probably later today. Which First Lady was responsible for bringing the cherry blossoms to Washington? Mm. This is kind of interesting because, you know, they make such a big deal every year about tourists coming to Washington to see the cherry blossoms.
Yes.
Have you been before to see them?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, me too. It's really fascinating, especially down near the Potomac and along the basin there. But that was Helen Taft, Helen Heron Taft. In 1912, she arranged for the planting of 3,000 Japanese cherry trees in the Washington Tidal Basin. With the Japanese ambassador, Mrs. Taft personally planted the first two saplings on March the 27th of 1912. And, of course, she was from Cincinnati. She and her husband were from Cincinnati. So an Ohio connection to having the first cherry blossoms in Washington. How are we doing for time?
3 minutes.
Okay, I can do one more. Oh, this is very interesting, too, and this is probably another reason why she got criticized a lot. Which First Lady was investigated by Congress for traitorous conduct?
Oh,
Mary Todd Lincoln.
Oh, my.
Mary Todd Lincoln. Perhaps the most unpopular of the First Ladies. Congress was suspicious of her loyalties to the Union during the Civil War. for a good reason. Four of her brothers fought for the Confederacy.
Okay.
Four of her brothers fought for the Confederacy, and three of them died during the war. On top of that, she ran up huge expenses in purchasing china and furniture for the White House, which Congress did have to pay for. The president was compelled to appear in the Senate and say, "It is untrue that any of my family holds treasonable relations with the enemy. There is no evidence for any pro-Confederacy sympathy by Mrs. Lincoln. She was staunchly pro-Union." But what didn't help this whole situation was, on numerous occasions, she had the wives of her three brothers who fought in the Confederacy to the White House to spend time and have dinner, which always gave some congressional representatives and some people in Washington the idea that those women were spying on behalf of the Confederacy by being in the White House and being that close to the U.S. president. So she didn't help her situation any by having her sister-in-laws over for dinner.
I guess not.
It just kind of made things, you know, made things worse. Well, while we're talking about her, we might as well move on. Mary Ellen...
We're out of time.
Oh, okay. Pick it up on the other side.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in the next segment, which will begin at 11:15 to the top of the hour of 12 noon. Thank you, Fred Malone. And not only that, Fred Malone will continue to be with us. So thank you for listening to A Voice of a People here live with Linda Sims on WGH Talk, streaming live on the web, www.wwgh1071.com. Also on TuneIn app. Not only that, Facebook Live on my page, Linda Sims, and you will be able to see Fred Malone. Can't see my face yet, but you can see his, so tune in for the next hour. Till next time,
you're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, your place for politics. For Republicans.